at the Estancia La Jolla Hotel and Spa, just down the street from the Salk Institute, which, where we had the sixth stem cell meeting on the Mesa yesterday. And we're with Evan Snyder, who's the professor and director. I'll read the official thing here. Program in Stem Cell and Regenerative Biology and Stem Cell Research Center at Sanford Burnham Medical Research Institute, and an old colleague and friend of mine. We've been planning these meetings for years, so
that's right.
We go over this stuff all the time. Give me some sense of where you think the field has gone in the last 6-7 years since we did that initial meeting. I mentioned yesterday, I read stuff in Nature that says the dark side of pluripotency and so on. There's critiques, there's positive stuff, there's people, patient advocates saying 150,000 square feet of hope here.
Right.
What realistically do you tell people when they ask you where the field is going at this point?
So I actually am very upbeat about where the field is moving. And in fact, I think the field is now, it was just in its infancy 20 years ago. It went through school age, you know, probably in the last decade.
Right.
And I think now it's maturing, but not mature enough. It's kind of in its teenage years where you're starting to realize that things are not as easy and as clear-cut as you thought they were. So when you're a child, everything is white and black. It's very concrete. You follow rules.
Wow.
When you're a teenager, you start realizing that there are shades of gray. There's complexities. But that doesn't, you don't find that daunting. In fact, you find that kind of invigorating and exciting because you're starting to feel like you're an adult. You're not an adult, but you're on the threshold of becoming an adult.
Right.
And that's the way the stem cell field is. So we're starting to realize, for example, that stem cells do many, many things, which shouldn't have surprised us because stem cells were not placed there by nature to fix people necessarily, to make a product, to provoke controversy. Stem cells are fundamental parts of developmental biology. They're the building blocks of how the body starts taking shape in the earliest stages of embryogenesis. And then they hang on and they start putting organs together with all their complexity. And then after they do that, their job is to maintain balance of a system all throughout life. And the way it has to do all of these tasks is exceedingly complex. And it's not simply by cell replacement. It's not just point by point replacement. It's changing the milieu with various chemicals and molecules. It's detoxifying. It's establishing substrates. It's establishing a division of labor, saying, okay, you guys do this, and you guys do this, and I'm going to do this. And it also shouldn't surprise us that it's complex because putting the human body together, putting any body together, even the most primitive organism, is complex. There's many, many genes, many, many connections, many, many kinds of processes that have to go on, and the stem cell has to do that. So on one level, you would say, oh, this is not going to be something where I just take a stem cell, throw it in, and just let it do its thing. I'm going to really have to know a little bit of something. One, I'm going to have to know how the stem cell knows what to become. And then after it knows what to become, what is that job going to be? What am I going to make? Who am I going to partner with? Where am I going to go? How long am I going to live? And then if you're thinking about a disease, you have to know, well, what's going on with this disease? Which itself is a moving target. So even if you have the most intelligent, best prepared, safest, most efficacious stem cell, that's not going to be sufficient because I, as your stem cell biologist, are going to then ask you and say, okay, so what do you want me to fix? And if you don't know what you want me to fix, I may not be able to help you. So an example of where this has been a moving target is, for example, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis.
Right.
We used to think, well, this is just a pure motor neuron disease. You know, the cells that make your muscles move just die. So therefore, if you want things to work, it's going to be daunting, but just replace the motor neurons. You know, never mind that how you're going to replace them all the way up and down every bit of the neuroaxis is its own challenge, but maybe that's all we need to do. And then we started learning, well, ALS may not just be primarily a motor neuron disease. In fact, it actually may be a disease of the cells that surround the motor neurons, the astrocytes, and it's the motor neurons that are just the poor bastard that took the hit because these guys weren't doing their job. So all of a sudden we're going, geez, those are the wrong cells. These cells that we thought we spent all this time trying to replace maybe aren't the cells that we need to replace, or at least not alone.
Yeah.
So that's a moving target. But there we even knew where the problem was. Even if we got the cell type wrong, we kind of knew what cells weren't working. But now, what do you do for Alzheimer's disease? We don't really, really know what we need to fix in Alzheimer's disease. Autism, schizophrenia,
Parkinson's.
Even Parkinson's disease that you would say, well, that's a no-brainer. It's just these, we just got to put back some dopamine. Well, it's probably more than that.
Yeah.
Parkinson's disease patients also have an element of dementia. Where does that come from?
Right.
How do you fix that? So what I find invigorating about the stem cell field is that we're starting to recognize that even as we realize that the diseases themselves are multimodal and exceedingly complex and not unidimensional, the same thing is happening with the stem cell. We're starting to recognize that the stem cell is a dynamic entity with many different processes going on, and very often, if we're lucky, those multiple processes will mesh with the multiple needs of a particular disease. And that's becoming exceedingly exciting. How do you use the stem cell? And that's just talking about it in a transplantation setting.
Yeah.
What about modeling diseases in a dish, which also is something that has now hit the consciousness of the stem cell community in the period of time since we've been doing these stem cell on the Mesa things. It wasn't even a topic of conversation at first stem cell on the Mesa.
No.
And now it dominated
diseases
it
on
here.
The dish we did last year. That was the first time we did it.
The first time we did it. And now it dominates some of the conversation. Well, that's a pretty rapid change in a very short period of time. But the potential to say, well, you know, now it's not going to be the stem cell that goes into the patient, but the drug you discovered from the stem cell that goes into the patient. Well, that's a completely new area. And then there's the other recognition of changing stem cells that the patient already has and seeing whether you can get the stem cell to do a repair or prevent the stem cell from doing something nasty, like dying when it shouldn't be dying, which could be the cause of neurodegenerative diseases, or going to the dark side, which could be the cause of cancer. Can we tame the stem cell so it doesn't do anything nasty? And maybe if we're really lucky, get it to go and become what we want it to be for the sake of repair. And then finally, just recognizing that endogenous, our own stem cells are responsive to environmental cues.
Yeah.
So we learn that they read environmental cues like enrichment and exercise and stimulation and activity. Well, now that means that patients with Parkinson's disease take ballroom dancing lessons, and patients with Alzheimer's are forced to do video games, and kids are stimulated from the very beginning. And physical therapy is actually really important after a spinal cord injury. It's not simply because we can't think of anything else to do. It's actually a stem cell therapy.
Right. So put this in a larger context, if you would. Let's go back even further.
Okay.
And let's talk about the relationship between the concept of neurogenesis and stem cells. Okay. There was a given at one point, which is that you have 10 to the 10 neurons, and that's it, and they decrease as you age, and that's it. You've got no new brain cells being made. Strange potted history here. Joe Altman, 1962, suggests that there is something called neurogenesis. Michael Kaplan, a decade later, both of them are dissed, you know?
And even earlier than that, there was Richard Sidman in 1959 publishing a paper that there is still cell division in the subventricular zone of adults.
But here we are now. We now have a position where we actually have really good work that shows mm-hmm. that there is a thing called neurogenesis. You can make new brain cells,
right.
Dentate gyrus and so on mm-hmm. and so forth. This is intimately connected with stem cell work. Mm-hmm. Because that's where a lot of the regeneration goes on. Could you speak to that for me?
Well, I think that
changing the scientific concept of
What the stem cell field in general did, in the broadest sense, was say that certainly the nervous system, and I would have to say that the nervous system actually. And I'll show my chauvinistic roots for neuroscience, was the leading edge of regenerative medicine. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the hematologist had talked about stem cells as the cell that was most effective in repopulating a lethally irradiated bone marrow. And that simply was a process of figuring out, well, who divides the most and repopulates the most, but it was not surprising that the bone marrow would have stem cells because this is an organ that turns itself over routinely. So that was not kind of a paradigm shift to simply identify a stem cell in hematopoiesis. However, when you talk about the brain, the nervous system, well, this was an organ that, as you indicated, was felt to be absolutely rigid. Right. What you were born with was what you had forever. You lose it, it's gone. Very, very deterministic as well. Once you start recognizing that there are cells that exist, not just in embryogenesis, but much later than you would ever expect, that not only live there, but can change their fate and replace things, all of a sudden you accept that there's a plasticity that was unanticipated. And once you say, wow, my God, this rigid organ is actually not so rigid, it's dynamic, it's actually plastic, it's malleable, it can be changed much later than you think, then you start going, well, what are the possibilities? And then finally you go, and not only does this organ have its stem cells, mm-hmm. which is what we started calling them, to start moving around and changing fate, but you can now pull them out, isolate them, grow them in a dish, expand them, and take kind of this essence of plasticity and put it back when and where you want to do all kinds of various things for repair, all of a sudden you say, I am regenerating what was thought to be a non-regenerative organ, and right. I'm doing it under will.
Right.
And that, in my view, is what gave rise to the concept of regenerative medicine. And then what started happening is every other organ started saying, I wonder if my organ does what those brain guys are finding. And that's when they started finding it in heart and pancreas and liver. With the notion that not only do we see this regeneration, but maybe we can capture it and transplant it and use it. So I think that the stem cell field, whether it's ongoing neurogenesis or the fact that you can isolate cells, expand them, and transplant them, was an astounding paradigm shift. It changed our whole view of the human body, that things are not cast in stone and we can change things, we can push things, we can correct things. And then once you start accepting that even after you're committed, you can push the process back, then everything changes. Yeah. Nothing is set in stone, and that becomes astoundingly exciting if you're therapeutically oriented.
So what's your sense of the state of the field at this point? I mean, I go to your website, right, at Sanford Burnham, mm-hmm. and it says your research focus is, we believe the study of stem cell biology will provide insights into many areas, developmental biology, homeostasis in the normal adult, recovery from injury. we're looking at a multidisciplinary approach here. Basic biology of stem cells, role throughout the lifetime of an individual, therapeutic potential. Great benefits for scientists and for patients. How does that, what are you actually talking about here when you're talking
to
somebody?
So what I mean.
No. When somebody walks into your into your lab, or somebody you know, somebody you meet at a party, who says, "I've got this." What hope can you give them? Where are we at?
What I think is what we've realized is that the way to use the stem cell most intelligently and for therapeutic benefit is to understand the language of the stem cell. What is it really meant to be doing in development, injury, repair? Understand that, and then not bend it to do what we think it should be doing, but take its natural tendencies, capture them, exploit them, augment them, and use them. And that in tandem with understanding what the disease process is will allow us, I believe, to correct things. Yeah. Not all things, but a good percentage of things. Things, for example, that a cell has died, or an enzyme is missing, or something has not moved to where it should, or there's a toxicity that's making a cell die. I think we'll be able to do that. Now, an interesting thing would be, where should we be, if this is really fundamental developmental biology, how far back should we actually be going? And now this starts getting a little frightening if I push it to its logical conclusion. But since I know your game, I'll play this game with you. So right now we keep talking about using stem cells to fix a patient with Huntington's disease when he hits 30, and Parkinson's disease when he hits 50. And maybe some genetic problem like autism or schizophrenia or a degenerative problem whenever it becomes manifest, whether it's day of birth or school age or later on. What about, however, remember I said the stem cell puts the system together from its earliest days. What about if you already knew that somebody was in the womb going to have Huntington's disease when he's 30. In the womb, in the earliest days, you knew he was going to develop a brain tumor when he's 40.
Or at least you knew the odds. I mean, you could look at Craig Venter's genome, which is mapped, and you could say, I'm really worried about this area, and this area.
So maybe what we do is, as soon as there's a pregnancy, or maybe we're talking about a day where every pregnancy is planned in ex vivo, but that's neither here nor there, that as soon as there's a pregnancy, you now profile that embryo or fetus. You know with some degree of certainty that these will be the diseases that will plague this individual throughout every stage of its life. So now you jump in with a stem cell and fix it early on. You change the genetic makeup. You make sure that now all the cells that populate the brain, or at least a good percentage of the cells, do not have mutant Huntington in it. They now have normal Huntington. So even if the patient develops Huntington disease, it's just this mild annoyance and not a lethal, dementing disease. Mm-hmm. So one could push this to the point where, as we start understanding diseases, and as we start doing personalized medicine, and as we start getting a better understanding, the use of these building blocks could go further and further and further back, so that then at someday, even though I'm saying, well, we're only going to be able to use stem cells for this class of diseases where you need to replace, you know, some networks of cells or certain kinds of genes, but it's probably not going to be good for these fundamental genetic problems like karyotypic abnormalities in every cell of the body. Well, maybe as we start going further and further and further back, we'll even be able to do those. which is a frightening concept to some, but exciting to others of us.
When you were 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Me personally?
No, in age. Did you have any clue? Did you have some sense that you wanted to be in this business? I mean, what was the trajectory here? Do you have a teacher or your parents? Or why science for you?
Well, what I always wanted to do from the days when I was a kid was work with kids. I had been involved in dealing with emotionally disturbed and underprivileged kids my earliest days. And I started doing that when I was, you know, maybe 12.
Really?
Yeah, 12, 13.
Why?
I thought initially I was actually going to be a pediatric social worker or a child social worker. And
that's a big mouthful for somebody so young.
No, but it was something that, and in fact, my father had many different careers, but his last career was as a special education teacher,
yeah.
And I was the one who got him in that job, got him interested in that, because I would be taking care of these kids, and he would come to pick me up because I couldn't drive. And he would see what I was doing with these kids, and he was interested in education. My parents had been teachers at various stages in their lives, and he devoted himself to special education in the last phase of his life. So what I started doing was seeing how resilient kids were. And that's what struck me, that kids were plastic.
But now, you were a kid.
I know.
How can you have that kind of...
I don't know. I was just always interested in taking care of kids and being with kids. And what struck me is I wasn't working, obviously, with neurologic damage, but I was seeing kids who came from devastating households, that broken homes,
yeah.
and great deprivation, financial, psychological. But kids were just resilient. It didn't matter.
But you'd have to have felt, I assume, you'd have to have felt kind of older than they were to assess their difficulties.
Yeah, well, I always felt like I was probably more mature. But, so it was just kind of exciting just seeing how plastic kids were just to life's experiences, whether it was physical illness or socioeconomic deprivation or even being emotionally disturbed. But then if you're inquisitive enough, you keep on asking, and I was always imbued with this notion of just how plastic things were, but then you keep on saying, well, why does this happen? Or why does this happen? Or why does this happen? Before you know it, you're dealing with behavior at the broadest sociologic level, and before you know it, you're working on cells in a tissue culture dish, which is what happened to me. You just become more and more and more and more molecular. So ultimately, I became a scientist, but always intrigued with what the essence of this plasticity was. So when we discovered that there was such a thing as a cell, a single cell in the nervous system, much later than you would ever expect, that could go down different kinds of pathways, even though my colleagues said, oh, it's a tissue culture artifact, I went, this is so cool. I wonder if this is one of the essences of this kind of plasticity. Because by this time I knew it wasn't just behavioral plasticity that kids had. Even if kids had real genuine injuries, like strokes or trauma, their nervous system would somehow compensate in some kind of way. The same injury in a kid did not have the same impact as that injury in an adult. And I wanted to know the essence of that. So this plasticity was a theme of my life. And here, finding a cell that could go down different pathways and you could influence it, I thought, oh my gosh, this could be the cellular substrate of this plasticity.
So you're thinking about the fundamental building blocks of behavior as a teenager.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, no, I was working with these kids. No, and in fact, what I thought was, I mean,
don't you reflect back on it and think that was kind of strange? Well,
yeah, I do think it was kind of strange. You know, see, what I really wanted to be was a writer. And I thought was going to be, but as my parents warned me, they said, well, you can't make a living as a writer. Mm. So since my other passion was taking care of kids, you know, in this context of being a social worker type or a counselor, I thought, well, that'll be my day job and that'll give me things to write about. I'll write at night. But, you know, I didn't see myself as being odd at the time because my peer group was actually people that were 10 years older than I was, and they were all committed to taking care of kids. So I was just doing what they were doing. I just didn't realize that I was doing it at an age that was 10 years younger.
Yeah.
But, well, you know, it's funny. I keep on thinking, well, maybe, you know, I wasted all that time. I could have had this head start. You know, if I really, you know, having these kind of insights later on, you know, there, you're remarking now that I was ahead of my time back then.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if I do anything, it's actually expected or I'm behind schedule.
So if I'd asked you, is there something you'd like to have done as an alternative career rather than being a scientist, then the answer sounds like you'd have been a novelist?
Playwright. Yeah, I have a real passion for theater. So I would have probably, if I had had a play produced at that same age, I would not have gone to medical school or gone to grad school.
Funny?
Yeah, I mean, and in fact, it's kind of interesting. So I've come to this route, I've come to this position through a route that's very different than many, many people come either to medicine or science. Most of them have always said, well, I was passionate about biology or gardening or astronomy. I didn't. I told you exactly how I came to what I was doing. What I love about what I do now and what I love about the science is what I like to say is the poetry of nature. That's what intrigues me. I think it's just astounding that nature could build a system that is able to put itself together and compensate and adjust to these perturbations all throughout life with very little external instruction. It's just part of this program that unfolds, and that's just beautiful. And, you know, and if you want to think of a system that's actually analogous to what we study right now, I mentioned that the stem cell, part of the stem cell is to repopulate or return a disordered system to homeostasis, to equipoise. Mm-hmm. Well, how does it do that? And if you were nature and you wanted to, you know, make mankind and then go fishing and not have to micromanage everything, how would you program a cell or the body to do this? Well, one of the things that's beautiful is one of the properties of the stem cell. So where there's something going awry, there's usually a break in the blood-brain barrier, let's say, and then you get this influx of cells that are inflammatory cells.
Right.
Well, it's kind of cool. The stem cell knows where to go because it looks for inflammatory cues. So now there's an injury, inflammatory cells go in, they clean out the area of debris and of infection and things like that. Then they send up flares, and these are these inflammatory signals, a second wave of inflammatory signals. That's what the stem cell reads. So it knows where to go, which is really clever, that it should read the signals that indicate injury. So that's where it knows to go. And then when it gets there, it has anti-inflammatory actions, and then it reads the environment and gets cues as to what it should become. So it's almost like they're firemen. A fireman knows where to go because it sees the fire, goes to the fire, puts out the fire, and then tries to put things back. Well, that's beautiful. What a beautiful system that just unfolds completely on its own. And you can go through many, many things that all have this kind of, what I like to say is almost a kind of a poetry, that certain cell types talk to each other, so that's how a pattern is made. And they bounce off of each other, like two soccer players kicking a ball downfield. So I often will say, and I said this once, and I stopped saying it because of the hard look I got in return. I came out of a lecture and I was just blown away. I don't even remember what the lecture was. And I said to a colleague of mine, I just love this stuff. I just love the poetry of nature. And she had no idea what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And I realized because I came at this tradition as a poet or as a, you know, through the humanities. Yeah. So my route is different. Hopefully the output will be as rigorous and as useful as anybody else's output.
Nevertheless, I mean, major scientific achievements here, it says here in your bio, the first to isolate human neural stem cells. How did you feel at that point? I mean, it must have been a...
Oh, it was really exciting. It was actually very exciting. But it was an extension of what I... Because we were also the very first ones to isolate even any mammalian neural stem cell and to do a transplant and find that this kind of plasticity that you saw in a dish played itself out in the brain. And at the time, I think, as I remembered, most people said what you were looking at is a tissue culture artifact. You know, it's just what happens when you do a tissue culture. And I had this different view that maybe this was really what was going on. Well, one way that you validate what you see in a dish as being representative of what's really going on is you take the cell and you put it back into a developing system. And if you see the same thing, then it probably is for real. But I had already been warned that I shouldn't, you know, that I should be going on to other projects and not pursuing this in any way. So I was doing all these experiments really late at night, kind of on my own. And I remember taking these cells, doing the transplant, and they stayed in the brain for so long, literally for 2 years. I did the animals and waited about 2 years because I had so many other things I was supposed to be doing that I couldn't get back to this to really spend time doing it for 2 years.
2 years?
Yeah, so we kept these cells in an animal for 2 years. And then I went and finally sacrificed the animal and looked, and this was 2 a.m. in the lab, and the only other person in the lab besides me was a grad student who was a buddy of mine working on something else. And the cells were marked with LAG-Z, which meant that you could do a stain so they'd look blue. And after I'd sliced the brain, and I'd been doing this a little bit at a time, but I'd finished and I was ready to cover slip and look under the microscope. And I looked at the slide, and there was this blue streak across the brain. And my first response was, oh man, I can't believe this is so important. You're so sloppy. When you labeled the slide, you let the blue pen that you were writing with go across the cover slip.
Right.
And I went, oh man, at least I have some other sections. So I picked up another section and I went, well, there's a blue stripe there too. And I looked at all of them and they all had blue stripes.
Yeah.
And I said, well, maybe I'm sloppy, but I'm not that sloppy. And it can't be that precise that it's the exact same place on every one of those slides. So I took the slide and I put it under the microscope and I looked, and the brain, this part of the brain, was just filled with these blue cells falling right into the right layers, making all these interesting connections, and then in other places becoming different kinds of cells.
This is 2 years old.
And this is 2 years later, nearly 2 years after I'd done the transplant. And my heart just began to pound, because realistically, what I was looking at was the very first solid organ stem cell ever engrafted and integrating into anything.
Right.
Of any organ at any time. And it was to this day probably the most exciting moment of my entire life. And I held my breath and I said to my buddy, you know, David, you gotta come over and take a look at this. Tell me what you think. And, you know, he was a little nonchalant. It's 2 a.m. He's kind of tired. He walks over and he takes a look and he went, holy, you know, expletive.
Yeah.
And I went, yeah, that's what I thought too. He goes, this is astounding. This is unbelievable. So that was the first euphoria. Then the next was, So how do we tell our supervisor that I did these experiments anyway?
Right.
So I sat on the data for about a week.
Right.
Not so much to validate it, but to figure out how I
figure
let
out
them
your
know,
story.
Figure out my story, figure out what the story should be.
Yeah.
And so it became really, and then of course became really replicatable and all that,
right.
And you know, ultimately became a cell paper.
When you think back to those early days and so on, you're grad student, so on and so forth. I mean, now head of a lab, what advice do you give to a young scientist?
Well, I guess the lesson of what I just told you was don't listen to your PI.
Right.
But of course, that's advice to everybody but my own students who I want to listen to me. But I guess it's, you know, be creative, let your imagination run wild.
Yeah.
Always ask a big question. Always be daring.
Yeah.
But also, you know, so for most papers, getting the initial finding is actually quite easy and quick very often.
Right.
You get 90% of your paper and what's going to be exciting probably fairly quickly. What is the last 10%, which are all the controls and making sure that you're not misinterpreting your data, that can sometimes take 2 years to get that last 10%. So the other advice would be, love what you're doing, ask a big question, don't be put off, you know, don't be daunted when people say what you're doing is wrong or silly, but also be rigorous and make sure that when you do science, what essentially you're doing is you're like a lawyer, you're making an argument, and you are now going to convince somebody that your view of the world is the correct view. So you're constructing an argument. And then there's certain points that you make, but then you also have to be so compelling that you have to rule out all the alternative explanations. So
right.
Don't fall in love with your own data. Be self-critical and figure out all the reasons why you're wrong.
Yeah.
But then if you've convinced yourself and you're rigorous, then you can start making the arguments,
yeah.
And then you,
yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah,
but think big.
Yeah.
I mean, don't ask simply a derivative question. Ask a question that you really think you want to know the answer to and other people really want to know the answer. That's my view.
You work at the intersection a lot as well, as we've discussed previously, of science and politics, society, and
right.
So on.
Right.
When he came into office, President Obama said that the administration would just restore science to its rightful place.
Yeah.
What is that place?
Well, I think, and I'd like to think that it goes beyond just science for scientific questions. I'd like to think that what he was saying influences economic decisions and foreign policy decisions, mm-hmm. and domestic decisions. It's the notion that things should be evidence-based and data-based, not based on preconceptions or superstition or gut feelings, that ultimately data determines what one does or does not do.
Right.
And when he said restoring science to its rightful place, I was hoping that he meant the scientific method for how we as a government, we as a people, make decisions.
Mm.
And if you don't, and you don't come to something with a preconceived notion of what the answer is, you pose the question or the hypothesis, then you go out and you get the data, and the data are the data, and you go with what the data are.
Right.
And I think that's what he meant. You know, very often, you know, in the stem cell field, he was talking, obviously, about this notion that, you know, that embryonic stem cells were believed by some to be little arms and legs popping out of a petri dish, which of course was ridiculous. And I think that's what he meant, or that people had these gut feelings about climate change, and would indicate that, well, I don't care what the data are, I believe what I believe. Well, that's really not the way to do things.
So, you know, you just reminded me that there's a very serendipitous progress in all of this. People think there's a, you know, I'll do science, I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll do the other one. I was talking to Ian Wilmot yesterday, and he reminded me that the reason he went to a certain place was for a girl. I mean, this is the man who clones Dolly the sheep.
Right.
But, you know, the little things that happen along the way.
I mean, right.
You doing, being interested in being a playwright, you also did the same thing, didn't you? I mean, like Ian.
Going to medical school, yeah. Yeah, at the time I was dating, I was dating a girl whose mother wanted her to marry a doctor. And I thought that this was going to be the, you know, the girl of, for the rest of my life. I figured, well, the only way that this is going to work out is, I guess I have to at least tell her mother I'm going to medical school. But to keep the charade up, I had to start taking some courses. So that's how it happened.
But that's not how you, is that really how you got into medical school?
Well, I got good grades,
yeah.
But that probably is how I got into, you know, I was doing some interesting science at the time, too, and I think it was a combination of, but I, to tell you the truth, to get into medical school, I did the bare minimum because that wasn't really what I was going to be doing. I was interested in some of these bigger questions.
Yeah. Yeah. I only raise this to make the point about how serendipitous a lot of this stuff is. The moment you say science, people think it's a step by step process. It really isn't. There's a lot of immensely human and artistic potential in there as well.
I'll give you a perfect example of something where you're, for me personally, my personal life influenced my scientific directions in a way that I am hoping will actually help some people.
Yeah.
So we may have talked about this before, but in the early days of the stem cell field, or the, you know, maybe not quite so early, but it was still early enough, where the properties of stem cells were still being revealed. And what I had found was that stem cells were very migratory, at least neural stem cells in the brain. They moved around a lot. And as they moved around, if they were expressing a gene, they would distribute that gene.
Right.
And if it was part of their natural repertoire, then they would distribute that aspect of their natural repertoire. The early days of the stem cell field, there were not meetings that were meant for stem cell meetings. We were always part of gene therapy meetings.
Right.
And I would be the last speaker in the last afternoon of the last day that would be things to maybe be in the future for gene therapy.
Right.
Or for neural therapy,
right.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
But of course, I was a junior faculty person, and I was very excited about being invited to these Keystone meetings or these, whatever these meetings were. So I would go and sit through the entire week-long meeting up until it was my time to give my talk at the very end.
Right.
And of course, I'd be given the talk while everybody has their suitcases in the back and they're looking
leaving,
at their watches, and I'd give my thing. But I would listen to, back then, the big thing for gene therapy was genes against brain tumors or tyrosine hydroxylase for Parkinson's disease.
Right.
Or treating immunodeficiencies in kids with SCIDs, for example, ADA deficiency. And that was always the model that was used all the time. And what I noticed is with the brain tumor ones, time and time again, talk after talk, an investigator would get up and go, well, you know, we took this gene, put it in this viral vector, we eradicated the tumor from the mice, we've launched a clinical trial, and it failed. And the reason it failed was that the tumor came back and we couldn't get all the, because the tumor came back because all these cells started invading the rest of the brain and we couldn't, there's no way to target them. And I used to sit in the back just listening to this and going, doing like back of the envelope Gedanke experiments, and I would go,
yeah.
You know, I bet you if the stem cells had that gene in it, they would hunt down those cells and deliver it.
Right.
And they I bet you that would fix the problem that these guys have. But I'm a junior faculty person, I'm just getting my lab kind of going, and the last thing you want to do is go into a field that you know nothing about, where you've just looked at 20 investigators, more senior and more advanced than you, talking about things like that. So I said, I had no designs whatsoever to ever go into the brain tumor field. But then, a few years later, and we've been publishing a lot of this stuff now, my best friend in life developed a brain tumor. And a really, really bad one. And I mean, so bad it was non-resectable, even straight away. And his kids came to me and they said, isn't there anything you're doing that can help our dad? You know, we hear, by this time now, I'd gotten a little bit of a reputation in the stem cell field.
Right.
And I said, I have some ideas. And I went to Harvard to the only person working in brain tumors I knew, on models of brain tumors, and I knew nothing about it. And her name was Zandra Brakefield. Uh-huh. And I said, and Zandra had been asking me for our stem cells for growth factor work. And I said, Zandra, we bumped into each other at a meeting. I said, Zandra, we've got to talk. I have some ideas. And you're the only brain tumor expert I know who has models. And I sat down with her, just a typical cocktail hour, yeah, at a meeting. I pulled out a napkin and I drew what I thought. And the model was that I thought that you could take a stem cell, put a tumor-killing gene in it, inject it either into the tumor or even away from the tumor, and the stem cell would fill out the tumor or track down invading tumor cells, express its gene, and or even like a heat-seeking missile, find the tumor cells and eradicate them.
Right.
And Zandra said, that's kind of interesting, and can I get the cells for the growth factor work? And I said, absolutely. You help me with this, I'll help you with that.
Right.
So this thing that I drew out on the napkin, I started doing with Zandra. And Zandra said, you know, I have this postdoc who doesn't really like her project anyway. Why don't I just have her come over to your lab,
right.
You can work with her. She has a little bit of funding on an Alzheimer's project, and she's not so keen on that anyway. So we started working on this project.
Right.
To make a long story short, not only did that work, it worked as we, just the way I just described it. It worked. We had IP developed around it. And now it's an actual real clinical trial coming out of City of Hope.
Oh.
That's already treated 7 patients. And
run and
so because
guys at City of Hope. I mean,
yeah, because you know, the postdoc who was working in my lab, you know, ultimately went on and got her own lab ultimately at City of Hope, continued the work, and now launched the clinical trials, which is also one of the CIRM disease teams.
Wow.
So that whole thing, which I think will make an impact on brain tumor therapy as clinical trials, started out as an idea that I had because my best friend had a brain tumor. I would never have done that without that happening.
I almost hesitate to ask. I mean, too late to help him.
Too late to help him.
Yeah,
but when we published the paper in 2000.
Not for other people.
And we published the paper in 2000, And of course, you know, if a paper comes out in 2000, that reflects 4 years worth of work before
Right.
In the acknowledgement section, where most people, you know, acknowledge their funding sources, you know, acknowledgement to NIH and Brain Tumor Society and things like that, my acknowledgement, in addition to those, goes to the memory of Dr. James A. Galambos. And that's my acknowledgement.
Put yourself in a larger field here. If I gave you a time travel token and said you could bring to this table or your dinner table anybody in any discipline from any period of history and sit and ask them questions, is there somebody you'd really deeply love to just sit down and grill?
Well, you've asked me this question before, and I've given an answer before. And if you go back into the archives, to be consistent, I should probably cite the same person. So I'll tell you who I've cited before to you.
Just trying to find out if you've changed your mind.
But I'll add somebody, you know. So I think the last time you asked me this question, I said Leonardo da Vinci.
Right.
But another person that I think I would also, if I were allowed to kind of populate my table, is I'd love to talk with Benjamin Franklin, too.
Okay.
Because there's a guy who not only was creative, but very witty and a great writer and very influential and always inquisitive and daring and courageous.
Right. Okay. Final question. What are you optimistic about?
I actually am very optimistic that there will be treatments that come out of the stem cell field within the next 5 years.
Right.
Not all diseases, and they're not all going to be cures. I'd never use the word cure. I think, as we've talked about before, I reserve the word cure for infectious diseases treated with an antibiotic where you literally get rid of it. But treatments, things that will mitigate the intensity or the ferocity of a particular disease, I think we will have for some things within 5 years. And I think it's going to snowball. And I think there'll be more in 10 years. And I think 20 years from now, just the way you look at a disease and you have the particular menu of this is the treatment for this disease, this is the treatment for that disease, one of those treatments will be stem cell based. Yeah. And it'll be routine in 20 years for a whole series of maladies.
Well, if anybody has got the energy and drive to prosecute these things, I'm sure it's you.
Well, I hope so.
So
that's my goal.
We'll come back and talk to you again after we've moved along a bit further.
Okay, you can do it sooner than 20 years.
And great that we had this Africa Consortium up building now. Are you going to be involved in that?
I am. I am so excited about the potential of just being able to talk to people who I consider among the brightest people and most creative investigators in the world.
Yeah.
And to realize these are my neighbors and I'm going to be bumping into them on a daily basis.
Yeah. You think there is something in the water here? I mean, it's there's something very collaborative about this, isn't
there? I think there is. I think that, you know, I was, my entire life has been in the northeast of the country. And I think there's something about California that still has this Wild West frontier spirit, you know, that anything can be done and anything can happen if you just have enough energy and enough will.
Yeah. All right.
And I feel that.
Evan Snyder, great to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.